Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We're your hosts this next hour, Paul Wearson and Dennis Hart.
Paul, it is always good to be back with you. As you have said many times, we're like two old shoes, but I think we still have a lot of soul left.
I like that, yes. And today, Dennis is wearing long pants for the first time because he walked to the station in the bitter cold this morning.
It was at least, 55 degrees this morning, so I had to wear something.
Yeah, I noticed that the Earth is a little further away from the sun these days.
I felt that last night, as a matter of fact, when
it was
dark.
Be 75 degrees later, so we're still happy campers. Well, we have quite a show coming up today, including a live interview with the mayor of Marshalltown, and that's going to be about how the community is recovering from the tornado that hit last month. We'll also have word about an upcoming protest march, as well as the latest on street construction in Ames and what it means for this weekend's Iowa State football game. And that's not all. Maggie Westfold is here with another one of her points to ponder. First, here's Dennis with the news from several newspapers from around the Ames area.
Thank you, Paul. As always, we begin with news from the Boone News Republican, which reports that U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue is going to attend the Farm Progress Show in Boone today, Wednesday. Perdue is scheduled to appear at the show's hospitality tent between noon and 1 p.m. Farm Progress Show, as you know, is an annual event for seed developers, machinery firms, and other ag companies to show off their latest products to farmers and investors from around the U.S. and indeed from around the world. It runs through tomorrow at the Central Iowa Expo just north of U.S. Highway 30 between Ames and Boone. On a related note, the News Republican reports that the Boone County Extension Service recently celebrated its 100th anniversary. News Republican also reports that the Republican candidate for Boone County Attorney is suing the Democratic incumbent county attorney. Rob Swanson, the Republican who is trying to unseat Democratic incumbent Dan Kolacha, claims that Kolacha slandered him and that Swanson's confidential personnel files were released illegally. And just in case you missed it, the News Republican reports that a recent event designed to help the Boone Humane Society get more of its animals adopted was a success. The society was able to find homes for 31 kittens, 9 adult cats, and 4 dogs. In the Story City Herald, word that a Nevada man has been charged with a series of thefts at laundromats in Story City, Nevada, and Ames. Authorities said 32-year-old Ryan Dale Dunn was caught on security camera footage breaking into the Story City laundry. Also in the Herald, word that the Royal Pony Farm near Roland is selling off its herd 74 years after the Richardson family bought its first Shetland pony. The family says it's the end of the line. It's shutting down the operation and the herd is being sold off. About 50 ponies remain, ranging in age from 6 months to 26 years old, and they're available in a wide variety of colors and patterns. The Herald also reports that the Story City Friends Endowment reached a new milestone. It awarded $2,500, the most it's ever given out, to 5 local nonprofit organizations. Those nonprofits are the Story City Fire Department, the Boy Scouts Troop 101, Judge Story's Theatrical Troop, the Story City I-35 Memorial Boulder Roof Project, and the Story City Historical Society. Also in the Herald, a story about the Broad Street Market, which closed its doors for the last time this past weekend. Joe and Sandy Carter had worked the store every weekend for 8 years. They say they'll still stay active, occasionally selling items online and at sometimes shows and pop-up sales. Good luck to them. In the Tri-County Times, word that Story County investigators were looking for 3 men who allegedly entered the home of an elderly woman in Kelly and assaulted her. The 82-year-old woman suffered significant injuries during the incident last Thursday night. Also in the Times, word that Ballard Elementary School students were welcomed back to classes last week, and they got their first chance to play on new playgrounds at the West and East Ballard Elementary Schools. The new playground structures replaced 25-year-old structures that had become potential safety hazards for the kids. In the Nevada Journal, word about an upcoming reunion, the 35th reunion of some of the best times ever for Nevada softball. Way back in 1983, when fall softball was still a high school sport, Nevada sent its first and only team to the Fall State Softball Tournament, which was held in Urbandale. Then in 84 and 85, Nevada went to the summer softball tournaments. That fall team of 83 is going to be honored during Nevada High's home football game on Friday, October 5th. Should be quite an event. Also in the Journal, a report on the second annual mini state fair that took place recently in the parking lot across from Story Medical Center Senior Care. There were animals, farm machinery, a cotton candy machine, lemonade stand, corn dogs, and more. Dozens of senior care residents took part in the event. And last but certainly not least, in the Journal, an absolutely delightful feature story about a 3-year-old boy from Nevada who went fishing for the first time in his young life this past summer and who managed to snag a fish that was almost bigger than he was. The boy is Trey Harrison. He and his family went to Canada on vacation, and he went fishing with his dad, his granddad, and his uncle. Sure enough, little Trey's fishing line snagged a muskie, which happened to be 43 inches long and weigh 20 pounds. Trey himself is only 42 inches tall and weighs 34 pounds. And that, Paul, is our summary of news from the pages of the Boone News Republican, the Nevada Journal, the Story City Herald, and the Tri-County Times. Of course, those papers are going to have much more news when their print editions come out this week, so look for it there. And I'm going to be back here on Friday with a look at news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. Paul, if you and I snagged a muskie that was as big as we were or weighed as much as we did, we'd be in the water.
That would be the end of the boat.
The end of both of us. The little kid, that fish is bigger than he is, and he, with some help from his parents,
yeah, and I saw the photo, and it's delightful. Yep. Now, I liked your comment about ponies being available in a wide variety.
They're available.
You know, I've spent my life looking for a plaid pony, and maybe I can find one over there.
I thought I saw you wearing one the other day, actually, a plaid pony. Thank you very much, Paul. Wow. All right. Well, Paul, as you know, it is 6 minutes after the hour on this Wednesday. Thanks for joining us on Local Talk. A tornado hit Marshalltown on July 19th. Hundreds of homes were damaged, along with numerous downtown businesses, the courthouse, city hall, lots of damage. Joining us live right now on the phone, Marshalltown Mayor Joel Greer. Mayor, welcome back to Local Talk. It is a pleasure having you here again.
Well, good morning. Thank you.
Oh, good morning to you. I guess the overall question before we get into specifics, how's the recovery going in Marshalltown?
According to the people that have been through disasters around the country, it's going faster than anybody's seen it. And that's interesting, but also kind of counterproductive. We still are hoping to get a FEMA grant, and if we look like we've recovered just fine, got the temporary roofs now being replaced and buildings being put back together, it's probably going to hurt our chances to get the FEMA grant.
So that's a plus and a minus. Let's talk about some specific damage. The courthouse probably was the most visible one. It lost the top of its clock tower. It has been closed down. What's the extent of the damage there, and how's the recovery, the rebuilding going at your classic courthouse?
Yeah, it's. I'm a lawyer, so I love the courthouse. It's the prettiest one in Iowa, and it looks like it is badly wounded. I had a trial yesterday, and we had to have that trial in a temporary courtroom in the Max building across the street to the south, which just kind of felt weird. The last word we got was it's probably going to take a year and a half to get the courthouse put back together and get people moved back in there. And we did lose not only the clock tower, but the Ladies of Justice and three of the four chimneys that were there, so it's going to take a lot of brickwork, a lot of masonry, and a lot of time to get back in there.
We should say, when you indicated you were in court, it wasn't because you were charged with anything. You are a lawyer, and so you're in court often.
Yeah, well, I get charged with things, too.
We hear that the courthouse damage is to the extent of $15, $16 million. That's a lot of damage.
It is. I'm amazed at the price tag on that, truly. And there was a building downtown, kitty corner northwest of the courthouse, and one store over is what's called Ocean City. It used to be a bank. It had these gorgeous columns, and somebody in the 1960s put up kind of a new modern facade back when it was a women's clothing store, and it was the facade was damaged, the new one, and so now we've had exposed to us the old, really pretty-looking look that the bank had. The estimate on that one was to repair that $1 million, the first estimate, to put the same kind of stone back and fix up what was jackhammered when they put in the new facade. That one also takes my breath away that it would be that expensive. So we're trying to figure out another way to do it and a way to raise the funds to just get it restored back to what it looked like years ago.
What about City Hall? That was also damaged.
It was, and we were able to have our first City Council meeting back in our City Council chambers on Monday, and it was nice to be back home. My office, the mayor's office in the main floor of that building, was untouched. There was a little damage to a few of the offices there. What happened was that most of the roof of the Coliseum, which is immediately to the west, landed on our city hall and did cause some pretty significant damage to a space that we didn't use. So I think we're just going to remove that space. But we are back in business and business as usual. We thank the library for housing most of our city staff. Library is only about three blocks away, and it had enough space, and they allowed us to set up our computers and phones and things like that. So we were able to get by just fine, didn't miss a beat, but it's nice to be back where we usually are.
Well, this is Paul here, and good to talk to you again, and I'm glad to hear that so many things have been done and so much has happened positively since the tornado. And just personally, I want to make sure and know that Taylor's Made Right's up and running, right?
Taylor's Made Right did not get significant damage. They were able to keep making the famous Made Rights, and they were one of about three places that when the tornado hit and we assembled at the fire station, they made a bunch of sandwiches and made sure that they got them up to the fire station. So,
well, that's a big reason why I go to Marshalltown. Now, what are some of the intricacies of qualifying for FEMA help? You said there's a plus and minus about how rapidly the recoveries occurred. I just wondered what guidelines they have.
Nobody knows. There's a woman that made her money in film and then established a nonprofit. I've forgotten the name of the corporation that she established, but the whole purpose of it is to put in touch a mayor who has been through a disaster with a mayor who just went through one. And so she lined up a conference call with me and the mayor of Tupelo, Mississippi. He also had on the line his city attorney, his top staff people. And they lost a lot of people, and they lost more property than we did. And he's also a pilot and a lawyer like I am. And so that's probably why she matched us. I'm not sure. He's also volunteered to come up here to Marshalltown and visit personally with us. He, along with the mayor and city attorney in Cedar Rapids and mayor, city, another attorney up in Parkersburg, and others that I have visited with, have told me there's no way to know what the FEMA criteria are that you have to meet. It changes. It moves. It's an interesting phenomenon to make the application and then hold your breath and wait and see if you're going to qualify or not.
Well, you know, what I really like about what you just said is that people who've been through this are willing to help and step in. Just a little aside, Tupelo, that's Elvis' hometown, Tupelo, Mississippi. But I think the main thing is that these people are willing to consult with you because when you're new to this whole disaster recovery, these are people who will avoid having you reinvent the wheel. And so they're an excellent resource. And I suppose they had their own direct experiences with FEMA, and that's invaluable experience in guiding you. I'm glad they're willing to – actually, the guy coming up from Tupelo – to actually visit and work with you personally, that's going to be great because it's the kind of interaction you can't have over the phone.
It is, actually, and then he can see what the damage is and help guide us through. Tupelo actually did kind of a handbook, and so the mayor wrote a piece about what the mayor should expect. The city manager wrote a piece about what he or she should expect. It's about 115 pages, as I remember, and was very helpful to see. And I thought that was really nice for a city to do that. You know, it's tough to go through a disaster, and then when you've recovered, it's commendable that they would spend the time to put together that handbook.
Mayor, we understand that a Rebuild Marshalltown Fund has been set up in your community. What is that, and how is it going to work?
There are actually two rebuild funds. One is for the whole town, including the houses that have been destroyed. And then the other one is for the downtown area. And a third fund that's been set up is to help the people that have been displaced. The third one is through the Mid-Iowa Action. I've forgotten what the MICA stands for completely. But they've been here for decades, and they've been helping people that are underprivileged and now displaced forever, so they'll be good. And so there really are the three funds there. The United Way also has a foundation and is also collecting funds to help displaced people, so there are actually four funds. How the Rebuild Marshtown Fund works is we have been getting good contributions from some of the local corporations and from around the country, people that have a connection with Marshtown. Some people who don't have a connection with Marshtown but think it's awful that we went through such a bad tornado. And so we're collecting the funds and figuring out what the criteria are to disperse them.
Question. I was in Marshalltown, just after the tornado, a week or so after, and the neighborhoods looked, some of them looked pretty badly damaged, and they were. What's the status of the rebuilding? With or without those funds, how are those neighborhoods looking today?
Well, we had a bad day yesterday because we had a torrential rain pour.
Oh.
So we have a lot of blue tarps covering a lot of roofs, and they don't always hold. And so I haven't heard the damage report from yesterday. We were lucky the first week after the tornado that it was pretty sunny and we didn't have any rain. It's a mixed answer on that one. Some have been repaired and replaced and look great, and some people are still sleeping in their cars or tents on their property.
Oh, my.
Well, you know, the thing is about a tornado or any incident like that, there's a big surge right after the event, and then you get back into day-to-day life, and everyone starts to go back to work and all this sort of thing. And then some of the fervor and intensity might disappear. So I just hope the community retains its spirit of rising up like a phoenix out of the ashes and continue to work and cooperate. And I really think that it'll look back on this time for most Marshalltown folks as a time of coming together, of pooling resources. And I'm also moved when I hear that people who have no connection to Marshalltown are helping to fund this. That's marvelous. One thing about the Internet and our instant communication and the social network is that people are aware of things so instantly. And it's really important to know that when you have a GoFundMe page or some kind of thing happens, that there's such a response. Another example would be all the money that accumulated in the fund for the Tibbetts reward money.
Yeah.
And that came from all over the country, too. And I'm glad to hear you say that people came from already contributed from around the world or around the country to help Marshalltown. That's really great.
Yeah, they did. And it was fun to see the commingling of different. Well, let me give you an example of what it was like. Our law office sustained some damage, and we have a lot next to it that had a lot of trees in it. They came down, and so we had a lot of work to be done to cut trees up. On a Saturday after the tornado, my wife said, "Hey, go outside and tell these people we're covered. We have a tree guy coming. We can afford to do our own work here. So go on to the next homeowner that doesn't have the insurance or the tree guy lined up." And there were about 20, 30 people. It was a mix of people who spoke English and didn't. And I think the age started at about age 5 and ended at about age 85.
Oh, boy. Good.
Were together. And all they were doing was going place to place to place that had damage, and they had chainsaws, and they were just working away to help people out. And so people that had never met each other, and they lived on the same block, now know each other because they're out there trying to remove trees from the streets to make sure we could get through.
Mayor, one last thing. We're short on time. Lenox announced recently that it's going to have about $100 million loss in revenue because of the tornado, but they have pledged to stay in Marshalltown and rebuild. How important is Lenox to your community?
It's absolutely pivotal. And at 8:15 today, I'm meeting the president of JBS. And JBS is the biggest employer in town. Those were the two that gave us the most concern. And it's critical to our economy and the people that live here that those two corporations stay. And God bless them both for saying they're here for the long haul.
Mayor Greer, we want to thank you again for spending some time with us. We will continue to follow this, and we'd love to have you back when you have even better news about your recovery. Marshalltown strong, keep it up, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. We love the media because it keeps the word out.
Marshalltown Mayor Joel Greer talking about the recovery effort from that horrible tornado on July 19th.
Well, Dennis, you've almost got a friendship going with Joel. I'll look at all the time you've spent talking to him and going and visiting the scene, and you're really identified with this whole incident.
Well, Paul, I think he could become a co-host of this broadcast. What do you think?
I really think
why not have him in?
Well, the world is changing all the time. And this weekend, climate activists will start a march in Des Moines that will bring them through Ames on Labor Day and wind up in Fort Dodge on September 8th. It's called the First Nation Farmer Climate March, and Ed Fallon is organizing it.
We are a part of the entire International Rise for Climate mobilization on September 8th. I think of all the different efforts that are underway, we're probably the most intense. Most of these events are going to be on Saturday the 8th. We start on the 1st and build up to the 8th.
Well, the route will be about 94 miles. We'll start in Des Moines. We have a press conference at the Iowa Utilities Board office, and the reason is the Utilities Board is the entity that we feel illegally issued the right to use eminent domain to the pipeline company. You know, a lot of landowners were very much opposed to the pipeline company taking their land for this pipeline, and many of them fought it all the way to coming up against eminent domain. And, of course, the company was able to use that authority because the Utilities Board let them do it. And a lot of us feel that's just wrong. And a lot of legal observers and a lot of folks who really understand the law just don't think it makes any sense that they were given that authority. Because eminent domain is supposed to be for a genuine public purpose. You know, when a sewer line or a water line or a gas line runs by your home or business, you get to tap into that. When a road comes by your place, you get to go onto that road and you can drive on it or walk on it. But when an oil pipeline that starts in North Dakota and travels all the way to Patoka, Illinois, comes through your property, you don't get to use that product at all. That's not a public service. And as a private investment, it should never have had the authority to use eminent domain. So that's the argument that the landowners and the Sierra Club are making. The additional argument is that the company was supposed to demonstrate that there was a public necessity, public benefit to this pipeline, and they failed to do that. You know, that's basically the foundation of the lawsuit that we're trying to support. The landowners and the Sierra Club allege that this corporation should not have been given the authority to use eminent domain. And so we want to support them. It's a very important lawsuit. If they win, then it could stop the oil from flowing across not just Iowa, but South Dakota, North Dakota, Illinois. That's our primary purpose. The other kind of secondary purpose is to show that these issues are important. Eminent domain is important. Water quality is important. Climate change is important. And that we can come together from various backgrounds, various perspectives, and find common ground. That's why it's called the First Nation Farmer Climate Unity March, because we have a strong Native American component to this march. And we have a lot of folks involved with agriculture, a lot of folks who are concerned about the environment. And we have a lot of common ground.
Well, that was Ed Fallon talking about the march, and we're going live here with somebody who is actually going to be involved in the march, Tacita Barfoot. And Tacita, welcome to our show.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about how you've become involved and just some background on why you're involved so heavily in this cause, willing to march, and just talk about that.
All right. I grew up in Northwest Iowa. And when I was there, I worked at the Iowa Lakeside Lab, mm-hmm. where I did some water quality monitoring. So I really saw the connection between our agricultural industry and the environment.
And so that gave you a background and an understanding of the interaction between agriculture and the environment and how that impacts water quality. And then somehow you got involved with this idea. How did you first become involved with the pipeline issue?
Well, it began back when I attended the Democratic Caucus to advocate for having a concrete plan for Iowa to address climate change on our party platform. Although I have a background in these issues, I'm not really much of an expert. I'd like to connect more with people who are experts, people who have been an active in this issue for longer than I have, and also farmers who really know how to take care of our land and our water.
And so there's actually a court hearing coming up. There's a lawsuit involved. That's going to be on the 12th of September, I believe, when the Iowa Supreme Court deals with this. So I take it that the timing of this march has a lot to do with that.
I believe climate change is really a central issue to our survival. If you look at the recent update on the numbers from the casualties of Hurricane Maria, you could consider the death toll from climate change in our nation to be higher than that of 9/11.
Well, in all the, it just seems like every day you tune in, there's a 500-year weather event that, you know, somewhere in the country.
Yes, yes.
And so we're just talking about more extremes, and that means more hot, more cold, more heavy rainfall, and all the things that we've actually seen come to fruition in just the past year, really. Now, talk about the logistics. Where are you joining up with these people, and what's the march going to look like, the route, and all that?
Oh, well, we start in Des Moines. We begin at the
outside the IUB building, I believe, isn't it?
Yes.
Utilities board building?
Yeah, the utilities board.
Yeah.
Now, are you going to start there?
Yes, I will start there.
Are you doing the entire 94, 95 miles?
I am.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
I've gone on RagBri a few times.
Oh, you're RagBri.
Yes.
You're ready. But you can't take your bike on this one, right? You're going to be walking this one.
That's correct.
Yeah, there are no wheels allowed. But you're probably going to have camaraderie. Now, how many miles will you make the first day? What's the plan?
It's about 10 to 15 miles a day. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the specifics of every single day.
And then everyone camps out together at
night?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you have all this camaraderie, a campfire. And as you mentioned, you're going to learn a lot from the people who are your fellow marchers. And you're going to identify people of like mind who have the same motive and excitement about this issue as you do. So I just take it that the camaraderie will build even more of a feeling of strength and advocacy for your issue, you know.
Yes.
So this is about more than the public access or the public pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is about climate change. This extends beyond this particular issue.
Yes, it does. Well, I've seen the aerial photos and examples of the production from this farmland that's been devastated by the pipeline, and we won't get that for generations.
Right.
Get that back for generations. But yes, I would like to see the pipeline shut down.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see some consequences for this legal action that has happened.
And it sets a precedent for future proposals for pipelines, and so it might have a lot of long-term impact. I read in the articles in the paper about this issue that farmers describe the compaction of the soil because of the pressures involved. And so this limits root systems and some of the things that really influence how plants and crops grow. So, it's been a pleasure having you, Tasita. I hope for a pleasant march, for great camaraderie for you, and for good weather and no rainy, rain-soaked campsites.
Good luck on your march.
Yes.
Thank you.
And don't get trench foot, okay?
All right, I will try not to. It's been a pleasure.
Tasita Barfoot from the march.
That is the great Dave Brubeck with Those Foolish Things. No foolish things here. This is Local Talk. It's Wednesday. My name is Dennis Hart, and your name is?
Paul Wearson, and I once spent an afternoon with Dave Brubeck.
That is a story that
Decorah,
we have to tell.
In Iowa. He's a nice man.
Dave Brubeck, great.
Was a nice man.
Great performer. Great performer. Well, we have another great performer right here, an expert who's been with us many times before, Mark Ganson, City of Ames engineer, who has a lot to talk about today about some road projects that are going to impact virtually everybody, particularly this weekend with the first Iowa State University home football game, Mark, 60,000 people, some of them, in fact, sometimes it seems all of them coming up Duff Avenue get into the stadium. And as people may know right now, Duff Avenue has been closed for, more than a month for a lot of rebuilding work. What's the status, Mark? Is that baby going to open in time for this football game?
We will get it open. The schedule as of right now is 5 a.m. Friday morning, reopening South Duff. So you can expect South Duff to be open for the Friday commute as well as the trip to the football game on Saturday.
Those are big promises now, Mark. You've got to come through with that. Talk about what's been going on South Duff. That's been a major, big project.
Yep, it's been a big project. The work that we've done so far is essentially a concrete overlay of the existing pavement. So the project includes overlaying the existing pavement as well as widening it. So we have three lanes all the way down to Ken Merrill.
And the reason for that is because there's a lot of construction that's going on down there, including a new apartment complex. That's going to impact the amount of traffic on that road. It's bad enough for a lot of people now. It's going to get worse.
That's right. That's right. So the development essentially spurred or initiated the project. But then in our long-range transportation plan, we did note that improvements need to be made all the way down to Ken Merrill. The development doesn't really impact traffic that far south, but by extending that three-lane section all the way down to Ken Merrill, we do make improvements for the Southdale and Tea Garden residents.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, were you worried about this deadline? Were you sweating this?
Well, it depends on the day, and it depends on the forecast. So,
yeah.
Unfortunately, Friday calls for rain, but we have a couple days here to get everything buttoned up and get it reopened then. There will be extensive work that continues once we do reopen on Friday. There's a good chance that there are delays in the future as some work continues. So we're basically able to have two lanes of traffic restored. But as they work on that third lane, there will be times that we probably need to close the adjacent lane just to allow them room to perform their construction safely and have concrete trucks and everything else in
there. So it's not really done then. It's going to be open for the game, but you're still working.
Exactly. The work's going to extend basically through the rest of fall.
Oh, it is?
Yep, yep. It's a pretty large project. Driveways still need to be built. We have a shared-use path that's extending all the way down to Ken Merrill on the east side of the road. That still needs to be built. So we had approximately a one-month closure. So the focus of that really was to get the overlay done on those existing lanes and then reopen traffic and then work on all the adjacent work as best as possible. So it's still going to be a big project moving forward. Yeah, there's a good possibility. So when we are doing the work on that widening, you could expect flaggers for some of those days. We'll try and minimize that as much as possible and keep two lanes open as best as we can. But to allow those guys to work safely, it will be a lane closed at some point.
Well, the main thing about it is that, you know, we're asking for tolerance here because
yes,
people have to be patient. And I'm one of those people who's very passive about this. You know, I've never been a participant in road rage, never said bad words behind the wheel other than, get moving, sir. But, you know, what we really have to do is be apparently tolerant about long-range planning and looking at the future. And so you're involved heavily in – anticipating needs and looking to the future, and that really depends on development and what happens in town, doesn't it?
That's right. You know, the growth of the community is essential, and we seem to be sitting pretty good when it comes to that area. But part of that certainly is some of the inconveniences that go with the improvements that we're making. We certainly hope that everyone views them as improvements when we're done, and they can get through there hopefully a little quicker, hopefully a little more safely. But it is a part of a growing community, absolutely.
Mark, let's talk about another major project, South Duff, of course, north and south, a major route through the city, 13th Street.
You bet.
Major east-west route, and that baby has been closed now for a couple of months.
Yep.
Because of construction right around between Ridgewood and Curtis, and now it's from Curtis to Harding that it's closed down. Talk about the status of that major project.
Absolutely. So that one keeps moving forward. As you mentioned, we moved along to the Curtis to Harding section so that we could reopen the whole street a little sooner this fall. The next big change there is going to be reopening the west half. So the area from the railroad tracks over to Curtis. We're still hoping for Friday being able to reopen it. We have a couple issues with some private utility fixtures that need to get relocated so we can pour a shared use path on the south side of 13th Street across the railroad tracks. We're hoping that we can get that resolved quickly and get that path paved yet this week. Contractor's been great. They've been buttoning up driveways and intersections, all the small things that need to get done before we can reopen a street. So we are still working diligently to try and get the west half open.
But now you say you're going to open that, you hope to, but when I went by there a couple of days ago, there's still a lot of work to be done on sidewalks and the cross streets in there. Is that going to be done?
Yes. So that work would be done before we reopen it, and that's the stuff that can take quite a while. You know, paving the street goes really quickly, but when you have to do all the intersections and all the driveways and all the sidewalks, you know, that stuff takes time. So we're hoping we can get it reopened Friday. Hopefully that's not too ambitious, but we're certainly working towards it.
Well, what's your when you look at a standard year, when do things have to shut down due to weather? Is it usually November, December, when you can't do concrete anymore and this sort of thing?
Yeah, it's usually November. Mid-November is pretty good planning point. Mm-hmm. We try and be a little proactive and try and get projects done in late October just because November can be so unpredictable. But, yeah, that November is really when it seems to shut down pretty quick on us.
See, that's why I'm so tolerant. When I drive through construction areas, I figure we want this done now so that this winter I won't be wrecking my tires on something that's not, you know, potholes, et cetera. So I really appreciate not only the fact that that has to be done, I'm very patient, but not all people are. And I bet you get a few calls at the people say, my street isn't done.
We do. We certainly get some calls, and we address them as best as possible. You know, this year really, for having projects on two major streets, the calls really haven't been too high, which I think speaks to, you know, both all of our contractors doing great work, as well as people maybe being a little more patient this year and just letting us do the project and get it reopened when we can.
You know, as I've walked by that area, and I walk through Old Town and the Roosevelt neighborhood a lot because I live there, but I see that those side streets, those houses on the streets, such as Curtis or for Northwestern, I wonder if they haven't secretly enjoyed that street being shut down because there's been no traffic going by their houses for now weeks. It's
right.
Quiet there.
They're
on
probably walking through their houses nude now. There's no one looking through
the picture. I don't
know
about that. But.
No, it's a very good point, and it is. We do get some comments every now and again about that from property owners. You know, South Duff would be the same way.
Yeah.
You know, the people that live on South Duff are used to, you know, quite a bit of traffic coming through
there.
And for, you know, despite the construction equipment, it is kind of quiet for a month.
Nude people walking through their houses. I'd never thought of that in terms of construction.
It's a strange vision,
yeah.
But, you know, it's possible now that there are no cars going
by.
Well,
it's very possible, I guess.
But I think the main thing here is to understand the complexities that the city deals with in putting these things in and the forward-looking planning that needs to be done and the realistic estimate of what can be done in one season. And you also mentioned the complex interactions here. There are utilities, private driveways.
Right.
All kinds of interaction between people who may not always be in concert with each other.
One more quick question, Mark, before we let you go. You said that the west part of the 13th Street project you hope to open by Friday. What about the rest of it, the east part?
Unfortunately, that won't be Friday. Probably a couple months out on that one. So they are currently working on water main. Probably have water main work about two-thirds of the way done. And then you'll see some improvements made to the existing sanitary sewer system as well as the storm sewer system. Same thing as what we had on the west side. And then we'll backfill. We'll get everything ready to pave, and we'll move forward with the paving and all the other adjacent work.
So folks need to realize 13th Street is still not going to be open east to west for maybe until November,
it
as
could
we
be.
Say.
It could be.
And everyone, we say, be patient.
Be patient.
Be patient. Not only has he been kind enough to come in today, but Mark is wearing a real sharp pullover jacket that says, City of Ames Engineering. And means it, too.
In fact, Mark, Paul and I would like to have one of those when we host this broadcast. Could you give us one of those jackets? We'd love to have one.
I don't qualify as an engineer, though.
Well, Aladdin does. He wants one.
There you go.
Mark Genson, City of Ames, again, thank you for coming in. We'll have you back, okay?
You bet. Thanks
thank
for having
you very
me.
Much. Well,
yes, Mark, outstanding. And, man, I just think that you do a great job.
Yes.
I don't live in Ames. I live in Story City. But when I drive through, I often give thanks for the condition of the streets.
Right. But Maggie lives in Story City.
Yeah,
no, she lives in Ames,
she
just
lives in
north
Ames,
of me on Duff Avenue.
Yeah, Maggie is our next person here. She's got her wonderful segment entitled Points to Ponder. Maggie.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you. Hello again, KHOI listeners. And thank you, Dennis and Paul. On Points to Ponder today, folks, I'm talking lutefisk and other Scandinavian delicacies. According to my DNA sampling, my bloodline is 63% Irish. So I just round that up and I tell folks I'm of Irish descent. But then 51 years ago, I married a guy whose grandparents all immigrated here from Norway, arriving through Ellis Island. Two of my older sisters had by then married great guys, both Scandinavian. So I've been eating these foods for nearly 60 years. My earliest taste of something traditionally Norwegian was at my sis's house in Roland, Iowa, a town still heavily populated with Norwegian folks. I was about 14 when I first went for that overnight and was served leftover ham and kumla refried in butter. I was in heaven. Folks, if you have not sampled this deliciousness, I recommend it. If you enjoy scalloped potatoes and ham as a comfort food, you would love ham and kumla topped with butter. Lots of butter. Comfort, however, may not be the word to describe the after effect of kumla. I caution you, discomfort may occur if you don't put your fork down between bites and let your tummy catch up with your appetite. Before you know it, you're on the couch, appetite satiated, but groaning your compliments to the cook. As a new bride at 21 years, married to Norwegian Steve, who was raised on ham and kumla, I naturally felt I should try to make it for him. It has actually been kind of a fun husband-wife project from the beginning. The ham butt portion is covered in water, salted, peppered, and simmered for several hours on the back burner, and you can just imagine the aroma that overtakes the house. We both peel potatoes, then the cut-up potatoes are coarsely ground by hand in a meat grinder, which goes more quickly with two. As for quantities for just the two of us, it was my husband's thought from the first time out that we may as well make a double batch with planned leftovers, of course. Many cups of flour and a couple other dry ingredients are added, so the mixing of this heavy concoction becomes laborious. Steve's stronger arm helps a lot with the last rounds of mixing, so the potato dumplings are then dropped into the aromatic ham broth to simmer. Careful tending for a couple of hours is all that's left before the enjoying. And all the work is so worth it, folks. This meal has been Christmas fare for our family for nearly 40 years. I love that our kids and young grandkids think of Christmas and ham and kumla. all in one memorable holiday package. There are other wonderful Norwegian foods I came to love. Fish and lefse, a combination of piping hot mashed potatoes, baked cod, and, of course, plenty of butter, rolled up in a soft lefse round and eaten burrito style. Yum. Kringla for dessert, of course. The little figure-eight soft cookie that melts in your mouth, especially those that Steve's Aunt Sophie and Aunt Marge used to keep us supplied with. Potato cakes, harinkaka, and one delicacy that my Norwegian husband passes on, but I do enjoy, pickled herring. And speaking of passing on my portion, thank you anyway, let's talk about lutefisk. That's the one, the only Scandinavian delicacy that I just cannot do. My sweet mother-in-law, rest her soul, prepared it for us for lunch one day, not long into our marriage. She called me at work, said only that we should come by to help her eat what she'd fixed too much of. Stepping in her kitchen door, she greeted us with, "I hope you like what I fixed." Trying to be lightheartedly funny, I said, "It'll be great unless it's lutefisk." The hesitant look in that pretty brown, those pretty brown eyes said, "Oops." Now, I had not tasted the stuff. I'd only heard tales about this cod soaked in lye, so my little smart mouth comment was truthfully premature. A person doesn't really know until they try something whether they like it, right? I guess she had high hopes. I did try a bite, folks, but that was only because I loved my mother-in-law. She looked at the look of that steamy, gelatinous, little wormy-looking mound on my plate she placed in front of me was scary, 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 scary. But what was I to do? I put a decent forkful in my mouth as she watched my face. Ugh. I think I swallowed it, but I truthfully cannot remember. She was so sweet about it. After all, her son, my new hubby, had not asked for even one bite. He'd been served at this table for years. There was always some backup dish to eat when Mom had her lutefisk. I'm fairly sure she was just holding out hope that her son might have married a lutefisk eater. The poor woman had always fixed it only for herself. Her Norwegian husband, deceased by then, had refused to eat something that would take the pretty pattern right off the oilcloth. In preparing this Points to Ponder, I contacted by Facebook a young wife and mother I know, Stacy, who lives in Norway. I wondered if lutefisk is still eaten by the natives, if it's considered a feast in the home country like it is by many Norwegians here. Yes, folks, there are many here who love it, and they will assure you that if you did not like it the first time, it was just because it wasn't cooked the right way. But I assure you, I have no plans to ever have a second taste. Back to Stacy in Norway, who responded that it largely depends on what part of Norway you're in. That in Trondheim, where they live, lutefisk isn't very common. But when they lived in Stavanger, it was more common, especially for Christmas. She's eaten it there, said her experience was that it really did not have much taste, per se, but the texture left a bit to be desired. I thought Stacy was discreet and cute the way she described that unforgettable, for me, thick slime texture. She also said that when she sees it served at Nordic Fest in Decorah, her hometown, when she's back visiting, it doesn't seem that a lot of Americans prepare it correctly, and it turns out kind of runny. Doesn't that sound delicious, folks? Runny, gelatinous, lutefisk? Right. Stacy shared another food, though, that's enjoyed in the old country, but not likely here. Dried reindeer heart. Can you spell traumatized? When I read her words, I thought immediately of those cute little reindeer I saw on TV back when the Olympics were held in Norway and the Sami people marched in the opening ceremonies. And, of course, there's Dasher and Dancer and, oh, my gosh, people eat reindeer heart. Evidently, it's quite popular in northern Norway because of the large Sami population. Well, folks, I've just given you my Scandinavian foods experience as an Irish woman who, yes, owns a T-shirt that declares me an honorary Norwegian. I love Norwegians, one in particular, who has always assured me that my Irish blood was given a boost way back in time when Vikings landed on the lovely shores of Ireland and left their mark. I'll leave you with that thought, folks, as I cannot nor do I care to go into detail over the KHOI airwaves. Have a great day, and go find yourself a fresh-baked kringla to enjoy.
Paul, I was just about to ask when dinner is tonight, but then Maggie, you started talking about dried reindeer heart and lutefisk. I'm not sure. Maybe we should go out to dinner.
Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah, so happy. Of course, I'm a Norwegian, And I grew up with this. Mom had lutefisk, and this it's probably looks like jellyfish. It is gelatinous and has a horrible odor. Now, when you have someone coming into the family who's going to marry a member of the family and they come to Christmas dinner, they really reconsider that marriage because this is a horrible odor. Now, my mother was kind and wonderful, and she made a big roast for us Americans. But the older folks in the family feasted on lutefisk, and I never even took a bite. At least you tried it.
You've never tried it. You've never had lutefisk then.
No, Mom said you could still live here if you don't
it
do that.
It tastes as bad as it looks on the plate.
Is that right? Well,
I was hoping you'd make some and bring it in so we could test it on the air right here.
Well, you don't want to know,
I only make kumla, and I am so proud that I did kumla. Kumla just seemed easy for us, and my mother-in-law, I only knew her for 7 years. She died young, but she had already passed on the kumla pot, her kumla pot to me, and I felt honored because she has a couple daughters, and she thought that I was doing so well with that my husband was so pleased. We have the family kumla pot.
Yes, the kumla. It's just what my job was to run the meat grinder. Uh-huh. Mom would cut up the potatoes, and then I would put them through the grinder, and they'd go into a cake pan. And then she'd mold them into what you'd look as dumplings, and they are tossed into this long-suffering broth. In our case, it was brine, not, I think pork of some kind. Anyway, mainly it's a question of this long cooking thing. Mm-hmm. And then you cut it up and put butter on it and salt it. Mm-hmm. But the real treat for me is the thing that you do in the morning after the big meal in the evening. You fry the kumla in the morning with butter, and that is tasty.
That is the best.
And my brother's roommate came to visit the farm, and my mom cooked that in the morning, and he was about to leave. He said, "Celia, thank you for the wonderful fish." He thought he'd eat some kind of... But the thing is, it's a learned and acquired taste, and I've always thought that Norwegian food comes from a people who were snowed in for 9 months in a cabin.
Sure.
And they had
to
come up with something, and so that's what they did.
A lot of truth to that.
Maggie, if we came to your house tonight, if we invited ourselves to your house for dinner, because we know where you live, what would you serve us tonight?
Tonight? I'm afraid it couldn't be kumla. I don't think I'm prepared, but give me a minute. I have a pizza in the freezer.
Pizza sounds good. Yeah, that's fine. Pepperoni.
Well, Norwegian. Well, I think Norwegian pizza would be pickled herring sprinkled with some tomato sauce.
Oh, my goodness.
Maggie, we love you being here on Wednesdays.
It's fun.
You are a regular feature, and we're looking forward to having you come back. Now, don't tell us yet, but you're going to be back here next week with another Point to Ponder.
You know, this is such a good segment. I think Maggie will eventually get a call from CBS and have to hunt for a cheap apartment on Manhattan Island.
Oh, boy.
But Maggie, bring food next time.
I'll give it a shot.
Oh, hey, Kringla. You'll love Kringla, Dennis.
I know where to buy some.
There you go. You have been listening to Local Talk, and boy, have we been talking. We have been your hosts. I'm Dennis Hartz, so you must be Paul Wearson.
I am, and I think I remain so. Thanks for listening, everybody, and Local Talk airs today at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. We're at 89.1. Also remember that you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org. And you can find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also remember that KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, you can hear it underneath my voice here, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris, from their great CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk's a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, you see how easy it is. We just fall off the train. We will train you, just like we're doing it here. Come on down. Join the Local Talk team.
And today's program was engineered by the wonderful Aladdin. And stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening today, and
we'll see you again on the radio, but not with lutefisk.